Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening, this is your host, Dan Zupansky, for the program True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Raynella Dossett Lee said she came home one morning in 2003 and found her husband's body in bed, covered in blood, a Colt 38 by his side. But authorities were suspicious of Raynella's story. Why would her husband of 10 years suddenly commit suicide? And if he had taken his own life, why did it appear that three shots were fired? David Leith was not the first of Raynella's husbands to turn up dead. After digging into Raynella's past, police unearthed bizarre, gruesome details surrounding the death of her first husband, who was seemingly trampled by his own cattle, which led investigators to wonder, could Raynella have staged his death as well? To those who knew her, Raynella was a loving mother of two, a good neighbor and friend, a nurse who always reached out a helping hand. Was this woman capable of killing both her husbands? And if so, why did she do it? Out of greed, jealousy, or revenge? This is a story about what dark secrets were lurking inside her deadly web. The book we're profiling this evening is Her Deadly Web with my special guest, journalist and author Diane Fanning. Welcome back to the program, Diane Fanning.
Thank you, Dan. It's nice to be here.
Well, thank you very much for coming back on. It's always a pleasure to have you on. We always have a very, very engaging program, and you've come up again and found another crazy, crazy story. So let's get right into it here. And maybe we can start with, because there's a couple things that you do talk about in this book, and we want to talk about those things as well. But first, let's probably paint a portrait of Raynella Dossett Lee. And what's the proper pronunciation of the L-E-A-T-H? And so tell us a little bit about Raynella, and go back, because that's a big part of the story, where Raynella grew up and the background on that. So take us back to Raynella Dossett Leith and her early life and her background.
Raynella Large was born in the mountains of Tennessee. When she was a schoolgirl, her family moved to the city of Oak Ridge, Tennessee. At that time, people knew the name Oak Ridge, but it had a mysterious history. It had been carved out of the wilderness in order for the federal government to build a facility to process uranium. And the uranium that they processed at that plant was used in the bomb that fell on Hiroshima, and was one of the two bombs that ultimately brought an end to the war against Japan.
Right.
It was a very interesting place in a lot of ways because they still had air raid drills because the facility there during the Cold War, it was thought that they were a target. So it wasn't just air raid drills like people would remember of ducking and getting under the desks or going in the halls and covering your heads. This was the total evacuation of the town. They would just gather up. If you were at home, a mother at home, say you had three kids, two of them hadn't started school yet, you had one in school, you would grab the two preschool children and you would follow a route out of town, and you would not consider going to pick up your own child, because those children were then being escorted to a stop, one of the stops on the way out of town, and people that followed that route would stop there and load up as many kids as they could. And so people were just going around taking their kids and everybody else's kids and just heading all the way out of town.
Incredible.
Pretty incredible. And when the town was first started, it didn't have a name, and no one could speak about what they were doing there, the work that was going on. And so it, and because of that, they had lots and lots of scientists there, too. So you had higher than average education, and because of that, you had a better than average school system. And the kids there pretty much grew up with the feeling that they were a special segment of the American population.
Okay.
And I think that that had an impact on shaping who Raynella Large, which was her maiden name, the woman that she became. She went off to school and to be a nurse, and it was there at school that she met her first husband, Ed Dossett. And they got married, and he went to law school. She finished her nursing degree, and they set up house out on the old farm where Bill Dossett had been raised. And he ran for, after a couple of years of private practice, he ran for the office of attorney general, which is the same position as a lot of people call a district attorney. But
right.
In Tennessee, they're called attorney generals.
Right.
And they proceeded to have three children. Then Ed got very ill. He had cancer. He was still district attorney. But he was working from home a lot of the time. The cancer was expected to be terminal, but he had lasted for quite a while. And then one day he was found out in the lot connected to the barn, trampled by the cattle. At least that's what Raynella said.
Right.
Now, Raynella, because of who she was married to, had become rather involved politically, and she was an influential person in her own right, and played a major role in actually getting the successor to her husband elected to the position of attorney general. And she drew the ire of many Republicans. Her husband Ed had been a Republican, and she was a Republican, but she used the Republican mailing list to send out letters supporting the Democrat that was running for the seat. But nonetheless, she still held sway in the community, and after a little bit of anger over that issue, she got past that, and she still was a somewhat powerful woman. She had a huge farm that was now all hers, but she also had three children. So within 6 months, she ended up marrying a very close friend of her first husband, and he was David Leith. He was a barber, and he owned his own barber shop in partnership with another man. And they started off their married life together. Now, David had already had one child who was grown from a previous marriage and had two grandchildren. And Raynella then had three children. But she had another loss in her life when her daughter, who had a learner's permit, was driving the pickup truck and went through a red light at an intersection. And her little 11-year-old brother, Eddie, was in the car. And he was thrown from it and seriously injured, and he died a couple of days later. So Raynella lost her son.
Right.
Soon after that, she found out, because her first husband's secretary was getting divorced from her husband, Steve Walker. And she found out that during the custody hearing, Kay, the wife, had said, the wife and secretary of her husband, said that she, her husband, I really got that all confused. Okay, so there's Raynella and her husband, Ed. There's Kay and her husband, Steve. Kay worked for Ed as a secretary for years and years, started with
right.
his private practice. After he was dead, Kay filed for divorce from Steve. During the custody hearing, Kay said that Steve shouldn't have custody of one of the boys because it was not his biological child. It was the biological child of Ed Dossett.
Oh, geez.
So when Raynella Dossett, now Raynella Dossett Leith, heard about that, you would think her anger would either be directed at her deceased husband or at her deceased husband's secretary. But no, instead, she lures Steve Walker, the other wronged person in this adulterous affair, she lures him out to the barn under the pretext of showing him some paperwork, and instead pulls a gun on him and chases him all over the farmyard and across a fence and is firing wildly at him. She's fired 5 times when Steve went up over a fence and twisted his ankle and fell to the ground. She stood over top of him, pointing that gun at him, and she said, "Well, Steve, I used to be a much better shot, but I sure can't miss from here." And she pulled the trigger. Important thing for Steve, she forgot she had the 5-shot gun, not the 6-shot gun.
Jeez. Yeah.
So Steve survived. And then David survived for a few years, but only Raynella and Dave's doctor seemed to think that Dave was developing some sort of dementia. Everybody else thought he was just fine. And so it was a really confusing situation because Raynella kept saying things about how he wasn't right and she was taking him to the doctor. And then one day she left him at home, and when she claimed when she returned, she found him dead in the bed and he had committed suicide.
And when you talk about dementia, he's not very old. What's he, 57?
Yeah, he's getting close to 60. He's not very old.
No.
And, you know, I mean, there is early onset Alzheimer's. They can happen to people in their 40s. But,
sure.
You know, he still was a little young to be showing, typically to be showing signs of dementia. But that piece of the puzzle ended up being answered later on when when the investigators came to the scene and were instantly suspicious because 3 shots had been fired.
Take us back to the phone call, though. We jumped over that, and I apologize for that. Take us back to the entire event in terms of she calls police, and what's her demeanor like when she first calls police, and what is her actions when, I thought it was fascinating, when police come, they think there's another victim because there's somebody on the front lawn. So tell us about the whole turn of events and the phone call and how she acted.
Oh, yeah. She calls, and she was shrieking and choking on her words, asking them to help her. And the first thing she says when they ask her what's going on is that my husband shot himself. And she gives her address and tells him to hurry. And, you know, he's in the bed. And she said, I'm gonna throw up. And they heard her making all sorts of noise and gagging and everything, and they tried to get her to calm down. And they sent someone in. She left the phone off the hook and ran outside. So she threw herself prostrate on the grass, and she was looking for all intents and purposes if she's dead, and So when the police arrived, they thought someone had shot her too. And so they went to her first. They went to her aid first, but then she said, no, 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 you got to help him, help him. He's been shot. And when they went in and they found Dave's body, by that time, she was starting to look fairly composed. And she didn't act all that upset. She sort of took charge of the situation, and she
right.
explained that he found out that his mother had cancer just the other day, and that's why he committed suicide.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to talk about this because it's very important how easily they determine what's suicide and what they believe is homicide in this case. But they look at what they know that they got a call at this time, which was around 11:30 or a little bit past 11:30 in the morning, right?
Right, right.
Now, the thing is that they talk about lividity, so maybe you could talk about what that is for, most people do know, they're junkies like me to watch Investigation Discovery and read all the books, so, but for those that don't, what's lividity and why is it important to this case, and what, in when I talk about lividity, how is that important to this case and them finding the body?
Well, lividity is a discoloring of the skin that is caused where the blood in the body settles down when after they're dead, because you no longer have your heart pumping the blood. So your little capillaries that are all full of blood just sort of seep and go down to the lowest point because of gravity. So you look at when people arrive on the scene to investigate a crime, they look at that discoloration. And they also will do things like pressing on the surface of the skin to see how well it bounces back, or whether it goes white, or how it's affected by touch. And they can tell by the reaction of the skin and the signs of lividity an approximate amount of time since death had passed. And Rainella's story to the police would have had him dead not that very long. And it had to have been, probably they determined just by examining the body briefly, that it was probably more than 5 hours earlier. So her story was suddenly not fitting together because of she had claimed to have left the house about 3 hours earlier, and so if he had died 5 hours earlier, she couldn't have been in the house. And I mean, she would have had to been in the house when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a good indicator to them that there was something wrong here. And the other thing that on the scene that caught the investigator's eye was that it appeared as if he'd been tucked in to bed. I mean, he had a pillow nicely between his head and his shoulder. He had a pillow between his legs, and the lower half of his body was fairly, very neatly covered up. And next to him was a plate of food. He had some oatmeal on it and some toast and stuff, and there was no blood spatter on top of that food, which made no sense.
Right.
If she had served him that food and it had been sitting there that whole time, and there was no evidence that he had taken a sip of the water, there were no marks on it, no change in the level of the milk, and it just looked real suspicious in a lot of ways. And then when they saw the three shots, one through the headboard, one through his head, and one into the bed, it didn't automatically say that it was not a suicide, but it raised the question very seriously. It happens that somebody might be planning on committing suicide, and then at the very last second they turn the gun away, and then like we go through, like that first shot went through the headboard, and then they, you know, come back and kill themselves. But
right.
The third one into the mattress was just bizarre. That didn't make a lot of sense. But they didn't know immediately what order it was in. They didn't know that till they were examining evidence later.
They also had the benefit of looking at it later at the what's called gunshot. I found this very interesting in your book, too. Gunshot stipple or, gunpowder stipple. So I guess they know there's the effect with the gunshot residue as well. So they did. If you can explain that, but I found that fascinating in the book that was another way. They said it's a circumstantial case because they didn't have any eyewitness or a lot of things that they would have in other cases, but they had this type of evidence, this gunshot stippling anyway, that I hadn't heard of before, so it was interesting to find that in your book. So,
yeah, and what that is it's when the gun fires, it sends out hot gases along with the bullet, and that has, you know, the dirt and stuff from the gun barrel firing, and it flies into the skin, and depending on and how close the end of the gun is to the head, it changes the pattern. So you could actually tell the distance of the gun from a person's head when it was fired into them.
Right. And the result of the autopsy was as well that their conclusion was what?
They said that the gun was held at a place that, although not impossible, it would have been very awkward for him to have shot himself there. And the other thing they discovered was that the shot that went into his head killed him instantaneously, because it severed his brainstem.
Right.
So he could not, you know, you hear sometimes they say that a person will just involuntarily jerk and cause another gunshot to fire. But in his case, that could not have happened.
Right. Now, she arrives on this crime scene with her daughter, Katie, I believe, and they are both questioned by different detectives. When she's officially questioned, she does say some, you know, about the melting butter. They talked about what would happen that day, and maybe the quote is that I bring in his breakfast, like many times breakfast in bed, but I bring, he complains that I bring in the breakfast too hot, to melt the butter. And
which was a very odd thing to say.
So tell us about this early questioning and what the police really conclude from that.
They thought it was an odd statement. And initially, something like that, if someone were in shock or in, you know, extreme immediate grief, maybe they would stumble up their words, but it was something that really stuck with the investigators. And later they would, you know, it would come back and sort of haunt them as something that wasn't quite right. And they were very uncomfortable too with the way she was behaving. She wasn't acting all that distressed, despite the fact she said something that was basically nonsensical.
Right.
In cases like this, investigators really have to step very carefully, because although often the spouse is the person who's responsible for a murder in the home. There are still a lot of people who lose spouses to murder, and they had not a thing in the world to do with it and are truly victims. So you don't want to stomp all over them like you would an ordinary suspect in the beginning.
Now, the other thing that's, again, this is fascinating. When you look at this story, you say, okay, well, here, I think I get the idea, but there are many, many mysterious twists and turns, and I love how you reveal things at different times, so you keep us, wow, geez, really scratching my head, and then I go, I see why. But we're going to not tantalize the audience like that, and we're going to tell them now, Rainella is, because of this district attorney with the 6th Judicial, this attorney general she was married to before, now when she's questioned, now, and the other thing I found fascinating too as well, I just wanted to mention, is that you said that her first husband and her new and David were friends.
Yes.
That's correct, right? Now, they were friends, so the death of Ed Dossett didn't raise any alarms whatsoever. And then you also mentioned about Rainella having this power. Her husband was powerful, well, then suddenly he dies. No one questions that. But also, she attains a lot of that same power from that. So the thing that we're not really describing is, and this has to be certain, is that this is an imposing figure, like you say. She's 5'8". She's like 170 pounds, but she's a very charismatic, you know, strong woman. I found it interesting that nobody thinks anything but the highest regard for her. Now, when she is being questioned, even though it looks like she's the likely person, this Moyers, this guy that you bring to life in here, this very important inspector and lead investigator Moyers, what he does is that he is kind of concerned because Rainella has some powerful supporters. Despite what it looks like here to you and I and the reader, tell us about some of these people that appear in support of Rainella all of a sudden.
Well, you know, in her front yard, while they're doing this investigation inside the home, the who's who of Knoxville legal and political world were gathering in that yard. There were judges, public defenders, Republican Party leaders. They were all there in support of Rainella.
Yeah.
And, you know, Moyers knew this. He knew that the powerful people of Knoxville would have their eyes on him. And he knew he had to tread carefully. I mean, it was very important to him to find justice for this man. But he had to do it with great care so as not to step on the wrong toes before he had gotten the proof together.
Now, what happens as well, another little monkey wrench into this, or at least another little, again, twist, very, very unusual twist, is that the prosecutors in this, the local prosecutors, say, we can't do this because there's a conflict of interest. And so what's the solution with this? This is, again, very not very typical. So what's the solution to these people saying we can't prosecute this case?
Well, it is then turned over to a attorney general's office a couple of counties away so that they can handle the prosecution. But, you know, when you run for office, the most important thing to you is always the people you serve, as far as, you know, your ability to get reelected. People in adjoining counties that can't vote for you are just not as important as the people that are capable of voting for you.
Right.
So that made the priorities of the case drop lower on the list for this new jurisdiction. And in fact, until the guy that was serving at that time was out of office, the case didn't really get moving on the legal front to take it before a grand jury.
Interesting. So it was kind of stalled just by basis
of... Yeah. It just kind of stalled because, you know, you have the investigators in one district and you've got the prosecutors in another, and coordinating that and raising any kind of sense of urgency in a couple of counties away is kind of difficult.
But in the interim,
the lawyers stuck with it.
Yeah, I was going to say that obviously in the interim, the police know that they have a case that's circumstantial, like I said, even though it's a good circumstantial case. They know they have these other factors at play, and so they're continuing to investigate. So what are some of the kinds of things that they did to try to gather and bolster their case with any kind of evidence they could that would piece together this and kind of counter her account of what happened that day?
Well, one of the suspicious things came up in the toxicology report. They found four or five different medications floating around in Dave's bloodstream that should not have been there. All of them would have an impact on his awareness and alertness. All of them would give him problems doing memory tasks. And these were drugs he wasn't supposed to be taking. And Rainella, the nurse, knew exactly what drugs did and knew exactly what drugs to get to do what she wanted to do. And it is suspected that that's why she and the doctor she took him to were the only people that thought something was wrong with Dave, because she'd been drugging him off and on for quite some time.
Wow.
To set up this scenario.
Now, the investigators have to also, because she is stating that he was suicidal and obviously committed suicide. Are they gathering it? Are they speaking to, like, say, his co-partner, the co-owner of his barbershop or this hair salon is a man named Hoyt. So what does Hoyt have to say? Again, another close friend, and he knows Rainella, and we're going to have to introduce this character because it's incredible, his behavior as well, his belief in Rainella, yet he's a really good friend of David. So tell us about Hoyt and his ideas about this.
Well, you know, he was not at all comfortable with the idea of suicide. And the other thing that really, really bothered him was the fact that Rainella hurried so fast to get Dave cremated. Now, Hoyt personally had nothing wrong with cremation. He was thinking he'd probably be cremated. But when he once told Dave about that, Dave got all over his case and told him it was wrong, that, you know, if you got...
Well, we seem to have lost Diane completely, so we will just wait for her to reconnect. I'm sure that she will get back online here with us. For those listening, of course, you've been listening to Diane Fanning and talking about her incredible new book, Her Deadly Web. We were just talking about Rainella, and right now they are trying to get this thing to trial. And if you've been listening carefully, obviously, you know that it doesn't look like what should look like a slam dunk case is not. And here we have, thank God, Diane Fanning back on, so we'll reconnect her and continue.
Suddenly you were gone.
Yeah,
and I was
you were
talking
gone.
Away.
Yes. Okay, we were back with Rainella, and you were talking about, geez.
Oh, Hoyt.
Yes.
We were talking about Hoyt. And Hoyt had once told Dave that when he died, he was going to be cremated. And Dave got all over his case and told him he couldn't do that. You know, you can't go to heaven if you've been cremated. It was a very firm belief in Dave's head that he did not want to be cremated. And yet, weeks before he died, Raynella had prepaid for his cremation.
The other thing, too, that that he must have mentioned it, and because it was noteworthy enough to his daughter Cindy as well, that she thought it was odd because that was against his wishes.
Yes, and everyone, his good friend Gordon, everybody that knew him, knew that this was a very fervent and deeply felt religious belief. He did not, absolutely not want to be cremated. And, you know, there is no possibility that Raynella didn't know that. But 2 weeks before he dies, she prepays for his cremation. You know, that was pretty darn suspicious.
Yeah. The other thing that I thought was fascinating, too, again, this is, I read all kinds of these books, as you know, and this is amazing. A few days after the funeral, Raynella gathers friends and family at the home for a meeting. Of course, why not have your attorney present from A.H. Bell? So there's an attorney there. Now, it's amazing. Attorney has a tape recorder, and so Cindy is there, I believe, and Hoyt is there as well, and Raynella. And if there's someone else, please tell me. But what it is that I got to get you to tell our audience, what's the question this person, this is a lawyer with a tape recorder a few days after the funeral, and here's Raynella, and here's her lawyer with a tape recorder, and what question does the lawyer ask Hoyt especially, but the people in the room, and attempt to record their response?
Well, you know, he was an attorney for Raynella, and he was very interested in making sure that Raynella was protected from harm. So he started asking them questions about Dave's suicide and whether or not that they could testify to his state of mind, and it came out and asked him, could we count on you, basically? And Hoyt said, no, I don't think I could do anything to help you at all.
Yeah, it was the way the question was asked was basically, why did you think Dave committed suicide?
Exactly.
And Hoyt basically said, you know, well, number one, you know, I don't. So then the attorney said, well, I guess the meeting's over. And Hoyt said, yeah, you're right. So I found that fascinating. I've never heard of any kind of meeting like this. The other thing we skipped over too, because this is some real gold here, that at the funeral she says, I was nothing but Dave's hood ornament.
Yes. And why in heaven's name she thought that or would even say something like that at his funeral, it just made no sense. Obviously ran the family.
There's a lot of trust that this woman had built up and a lot of confidence in her that it's just hard to comprehend that even Hoyt, even going to the meeting, I can't believe that he isn't, that the light bulbs aren't going off already here, you know, idea here, what she's doing. So anyway, continue with the police investigation. How do they proceed with this? You say this case was stalled somewhat because it wasn't a priority for the other, now the two counties away, prosecutors that are coming here, and we understand why, because if it's, you know, it's politics, basically. So tell us how things do proceed at this point.
Well, eventually, there's a new man in that office, and he is essentially shamed into doing it by a public letter from Dave Leith's daughter demanding justice for her father. And and that sort of helped get the ball rolling. On top of that, the Tennessee State Police have some forensic experts, and one of them, you know, you want to have one of them testify about guns. So the guy that's examining the gun, the murder weapon, notice that it's a type of gun that keeps the casings inside of the gun. They don't expel when the shot is fired. And he realizes that there's two different kinds of ammunition in the gun. And he realizes, because of that, exactly the order of the shots. It went headboard, head, and mattress. And that became very important, because the severed brainstem, David could not have fired that third shot.
Right.
And it what the prosecutors and investigators believed was that the third shot was fired for the whole reason of getting gunshot residue on David's hand. So she put the gun into his hand after he was dead and fired that third shot through the mattress.
And that's what cooked her goose, or at least was the icing.
Yes.
On that anyway.
Yes.
Ironically.
Yes. I mean, yeah. And, you know, I mean, she did all sorts of things that were just pretty darn heartless. She sent... it was Hoyt. She gave him a cardboard box, and she said, give
right.
this to Cindy, who's Dave's daughter. And so he took the cardboard box and gave it to Cindy. When she opened up this just plain cardboard box, what was inside of it but her father's cremains?
Yeah, no notice.
I mean,
that's
pretty darn heartless.
Yeah, I would say, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it was when all this came out that people started looking back at the murder of Ed at the death of Ed Dossett. And what they discovered was that when Ed Dossett died, there was only a partway autopsy done. And what was done was the report was filed before the toxicology report was completed.
Okay.
And when the medical examiner later turned in the toxicology report, he was sort of waiting for the prosecutor's office to tell, you know, to talk to him about it, which they never did. In the prosecutor's office, there were people thinking that maybe, you know, Ed had... this was some sort of plan of Ed's to get more money for Raynella and the children, since he was leaving three children behind. If he died an accidental death, then it would they would get double indemnity on the insurance. And they didn't want to look into it, because the best scenario they could see it was insurance fraud, and they just didn't want to dig that up on a widow with three little children.
Right.
So instead, they just set it aside.
They
found out in that toxicology report, when they looked at it later years, that what he really died from was an overdose of morphine. And although there were a couple of marks on his body from the hooves of the cattle, that there were no way... serious enough injuries to have caused anyone's death.
So a bunch of people not really doing their job to their full extent, obviously.
Exactly.
Again, it's just part of the charm of this woman to be able to buffalo these people that are more, that have their loyalty to her husband. And yet, that's the striking thing that nobody can really put a finger on.
The only people that were really, really suspicious from the get-go were Ed's family.
Right.
They were very troubled by this, and some of the farmers out that way too. they knew Ed's herd. Ed had a herd of polled Herefords, and Herefords just don't stampede. I mean, they're not prone to it. They're more likely to step on a human body if it's behind them and they don't realize it. But they're not going to go stampede and run over people. They're very gentle. And the farmers I talked to out there said Ed's cows were even gentle for polled Herefords. So it was like really unusual that there would be an agricultural accident involving that particular type of cow.
So were charges pursued by police and by district attorney for Ed Dossett?
Yes, they actually charged her with the murder, but they didn't want to go to trial until they exhumed the body. And since there was such a sloppy autopsy done the first time, and, you know, it was only half done, and everything wasn't checked, and there was no notation, for example, of the morphine pump, which had to have been in him because it was installed by doctors before he had died. They had to look at that body again. But, you know, Rainella objects to the exhumation, and the judge decides to protect the sanctity of the deceased and not desecrate the body by digging him up again, which makes no sense to me.
And yet Ed Dossett's family, for the most part, or at least the people that would be the people that authorize it, they were okay with that? Were they okay with it? Because,
well, except for Rainella and his children, who were basically under Rainella's control, the only people left, his parents were both dead. He had no siblings. And he had cousins that he'd been raised with. But, you know, a wife would then have a stronger say-so.
Right. I see.
You know, so it was I mean, the two daughters that were living objected to it, too. I mean, they were on their mother's side, which is actually the typical reaction. When a spouse kills another spouse, the children tend to side with the surviving spouse because that's the only parent they have.
Right. So, in the end, with this, is it confirmed that she has killed these two husbands?
It took two trials. The first one had a hung jury. 11 had voted guilty and one not guilty. In the second trial, all 12 voted her guilty. She was given life without parole. In the case of Ed Dossett, the prosecution moved to drop the case without prejudice. They had doubts that they could win a case without getting an exhumation order. They had her in jail for the rest of her life. But because they had it done without prejudice, that meant that should by chance Rainella get out on an appeal with the murder of David Leith, they still had this. They could reinstate the charges again. So basically, Ed's death is just hanging over her head. And as long as she is serving her sentence in prison, I don't think they'll be doing anything. But once that's done, they are going to move and try to get an exhumation again, I'm sure.
Now, this the hung jury in the first one, that's quite an achievement, actually, for a defense team to be able to do that, let alone with just one juror, let alone two.
It was just one that hung the jury.
Okay.
And the ironic thing was, one of the things they were asked before they were selected was, can you decide guilt based on a circumstantial case, which there's no eyewitnesses or anything like that. And you know, they all said yes. But then this one guy who drugged the jury along for a couple of days while he was dilly-dallying and trying to decide, finally came to the conclusion, since there was no eyewitness, and quite frankly, you know, if you're going to kill a spouse in your home, you're not going to invite someone to watch. And there was no DNA evidence. Well, how do they expect to get DNA evidence when these two people are both living in the same house?
Sure.
And there was no smoking gun, as it were. I mean, you know, so basically he said that he could decide on a circumstantial case, but when it came down to it, he couldn't.
Right.
He wanted a CSI moment, and there just wasn't one.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, because of her connections, I guess it seemed to be, you know, when you have a good lawyer, when you have supporters in the legal community, it does make a difference. That person is afforded even more, you know.
It's not right, but it's true. Yeah.
No, it's not right, but that's what happens. I mean, that's the inequity of the judicial system. Money really makes a huge difference, how you're represented in court. So, and again, the treatment that you're afforded. You see, only celebrities get bail on murder cases usually, but you'll see celebrities get bail for years once they're charged. You know, so there's a difference. And but at the same time, I think everyone involved, illegal people especially, would realize this person is likely going to be convicted. And so you see a lot of times where the first trial, but subsequent trials, I mean, obviously if a district attorney refiles the charges or appeals it and says we're going to do it again, they're convinced that they have enough evidence, so they're not going to let go. And like you say, with this woman here, if she ever were to get parole, they have a solution for that too. So they are planning on having this woman in for the rest of her life. So,
yeah, and the twists and turns in this story were just incredible, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, have you ever heard a case where there were involved two medical examiners who pulled guns on law enforcement? I mean, you know, that was one of the bizarre things in this story.
Yeah, and you know, another one of it I thought was interesting early on too is that she's being questioned, and she turns on the television set so she can watch Joyce Myers, televangelist, on which I've seen, so I know who she is. So she felt it important that she not miss that episode again, kind of keeping with the demeanor of the police, for kind of scratching her head, you know. So she was wailing and screaming and laying on the front grass, but then later, soon after, kind of composed. So.
And when the police got to the house, the clothes dryer was running.
Yeah.
And the Moyers asked her, I said, well, you know, when's the last time you used the clothes dryer? She said, oh, that was before I left to go up to the school and the hospital.
3 hours earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big load, Mr. Brown.
Yes.
probably done, I would think. Yeah, and the other thing, too, that she was a nurse, but there was no blood splatter on her at all, so she didn't attempt any CPR like maybe
no
most people would attempt.
Yeah, no transfer stains on her clothing. And, you know, even when it's totally hopeless, if you really love somebody, you will grab hold of them. You will try to bring them back to life, even if, you know, there's absolutely no sense to doing that at all. And yet here she is. She is a trained nurse. She had a lot of knowledge at her disposal. You know, she wasn't just, you know, a nobody nurse. I mean, this is someone who'd been nursing for quite some time, and she was a charge nurse at the hospital. It was her last job. So she was quite experienced and quite expert. And, you know, the thought that she did nothing to come to the aid of her husband was a very, very suspicious thing.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's a fascinating tale, Diane, and I'm glad you've dug up just one more fascinating tale. So the book that people have been listening to this evening is your latest, Her Deadly Web, What have you got planned for in the near future? What's your next book project? Do you know?
Well, my next book coming out is fiction. It is the sixth book in my Lieutenant Lucinda Pierce mystery series. And
right.
It's called Wrong Turn. That'll be out in the UK. It comes out end of September, and the US 1st of January. Then I have another true crime coming out in May. It's called Murder on the Home Front, and it is about the Julia Scheneker case. And Julie shot her two teenage kids, and when the police arrived, she told them she did it because they were mouthy.
Oh, incredible. Well, it's always been a great time having you on my program and getting a chance to talk to you about your latest and greatest true crime book. So thank you very much for this, Diane. And maybe you could tell us about your, you have an excellent website with a lot of information that people might want to visit. Give us get a little plug in for that as well.
Okay, it's www.dianefanning, DianeFanning.com. At the bottom of every web page is my email address if anyone wants to send me any questions or comments. And one of the new things that since we've talked is I now have 10 of my 11 true crime books are available in audio. So for people who are commuting or might be visually disabled, there's an audio version of the books now that you can get from audible.com or on Amazon. So, we got that going. And, of course, e-books and, you know, so there's so much stuff going on.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, audiobooks were really rising in popularity, and then e-books came around. So I said, well, what about audiobooks? Now you don't have to send, a 4 or 6 pound box to someone's house with all these DVDs. Now you just
send
it to, so it's great. It's helping anyway. I really do think.
Yeah,
that.
When I used to commute, I had an hour long each way, and I loved audiobooks. I mean, it made the time go faster, particularly when you were stopped in traffic that wasn't moving.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a good time spent. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thank
you
very much, Diane. Good luck with this and everything you're doing. But you don't need any luck with this. You've got the advantage. Anyway, thank you very much, Diane. Have a good evening, and thank you once again for coming on the program.
Thank you, Dan. Nice to talk to you again. Bye bye.
Bye bye.